Hello and welcome to the Archaeology News Weekly. I am, as ever, David Connolly, your host. This news is brought to you in partnership between Stone Pages and the British Archaeological Jobs and Resources website. All the stories have been collected from various sources, and to view details on each story, including the source, please see the Stone Pages website at news.stonepages.com. But before I go any further, William, a listener from Santa Barbara, has pointed out to me that an article in last week's podcast suggested that the Chumash people were in Arizona. This was the article about the Arbor Glyphs. Well, I have to apologise and say, William, you are absolutely right. What I should have done is pay more attention to the Past Horizons magazine article about the Windwolves project. It was all about the actual Chumash people themselves, who are in fact a coastal Pacific group, definitely not a deep desert tribe. I should have actually said that the glyphs seem to be similar to Chumash images. But hey, if you do want to point out any more mistakes or clarifications, please do feel free to get in touch, and I will do my best to correct and clarify. So I thank you again, William. And now, with hopefully fewer errors, the main headlines from around the world are as follows. An amazing story to start with, yes. 7,000-year-old bricks discovered in China. But more intriguing is Bronze Age ritual stone enclosure unearthed in Italy. The seeds of written communication on cave wall is explored in a longer article, and we also report on a megalithic site found in South Sumatra. We continue the story of early seafaring based on new finds in Crete, and objectors campaign about a bypass near an Irish prehistoric site. And more genteel activity is seen at an archaeological dig in the grounds of Cambridgeshire College, and finally, Orkney Islands Council is providing lots of lovely cash for archaeology projects. Bricks dating back 5,000 to 7,000 years have been unearthed in northwest China's Shanxi province, adding between 1,000 to 2,000 years onto Chinese brick-making history, archaeologists have claimed. The five calcined bricks were unearthed from a site in the Yangshou culture period dating to about 5,000 to 7,000 years ago. Previously, the oldest known bricks in the country were only 4,000 years old. The Yangshou culture dates to the Chinese Neolithic period that flourished along the Yellow River, which runs across China from west to east. The site, covering an area of more than 200,000 square metres, was to be cut through by a new highway, and the salvage excavation was launched in August 2009. As of this month, over 2,300 square metres have been excavated, and more than 150 sites, including houses, ash pits and kilns, have been found in the area. The world's oldest unearthed bricks date back between 8,000 to 10,000 years in the Middle East. Well, who said that bricks were not exciting? Italian archaeologists claim to have found a stone enclosure which once protected the legendary golden bough. In Roman mythology, the bough was a tree branch with golden leaves that enabled the Trojan hero Aeneas to travel through the underworld safely. They discovered the remains while excavating religious sanctuary built in the honour of the goddess Diana near the ancient volcanic lake in the Alban Hills, 20 miles south of Rome. They believe the enclosure protected a huge cypress or oak tree which was sacred to the Latins, a powerful tribe which ruled the region before the rise of the Roman Empire. The tree was central to the myth of Aeneas, but in a second, more historically credible legend, the Latins believed it symbolised the power of their priest-king. The discovery was made near the town of Nemi by the team led by Filippo Corelli, a recently retired professor of archaeology at Perugia University. After months of excavation in volcanic soil, they unearthed the remains of a stone enclosure, and shards of pottery surrounding the site date between the mid and late Bronze Age, and that's between the 12th and 13th centuries BCE. It's an intriguing discovery and adds evidence to the fact that this was an extraordinarily important sanctuary, said Professor Christopher Smith, the head of the British School at Rome. The Latins gathered here to worship right up until the founding of the Roman Republic in 509 BCE. The story about the golden bough and Aeneas, who is said to have journeyed to Troy from Troy to Italy to found the city of Rome, was documented by Virgil in his epic, The Aeneid. Actually, when I must admit, the last time I read the Aeneid was when I was at school, but it is actually a cracking read all these centuries later. So nip down to your local library and get out a copy of Aeneid. You'll love it. The first explorers to brave the 7-metre perilous crawl leading to the Chauvet Caves in southern France were rewarded with magnificent artwork to rival any modern composition. Stretching a full 3 metres in height, the paintings depict a troop of majestic horses in deep colours, a pair of boisterous rhinos in the midst of a fight, and a herd of prehistoric cows. When faced with such a spectacular beauty, who could blame the visiting anthropologists for largely ignoring the modest semicircles, lines and zigzags that also marked the walls? Yet, dismissing them has proved to be something of a mistake. The latest research has shown that far from being doodles, the marks are in fact highly symbolic, forming a written code that was familiar to all the prehistoric tribes around France and possibly beyond. Until now, the accepted view has been that the writing appeared to come much later than rock art, with the earliest records of pictographic writing dating back just 5,000 years. Few researchers, though, had given any serious thought to the relatively small and inconspicuous marks around the cave paintings. Genevieve von Fetzinger, then a student at the University of Victoria in British Columbia in Canada, was surprised to find that no one had actually brought all these records together to compare signs from different caves. And so, under the supervision of April Knoll at the University of Victoria, she compiled a comprehensive database of all recorded cave signs from 146 sites in France, covering 25,000 years of prehistory from between 35,000 to 10,000 years ago. What emerged was startling. 26 signs, all drawn in the same style, appeared again and again at numerous sites. Admittedly, some of the symbols are basic, like straight lines, circles and triangles, but the fact that many of the more complex designs also appeared in several places hinted to Genevieve and Noel that they were meaningful, perhaps even the seeds of written communication. A closer look confirmed their suspicions, and when they went back to some of the records of cave walls, she noticed other, less abstract signs that appeared to represent a single part of a larger figure. Like the tusk of a mammoth without an accompanying body, this feature is commonly known in pictographic languages. To von Fetzinger and Noah, it demonstrated that our ancestors were indeed considering how to represent ideas symbolically rather than realistically, eventually leading to the abstract symbols that were the basis of the original study. It was a way of communicating information in a concise way. For example, the mammoth tusks may have simply represented a mammoth, or perhaps a mammoth hunt, or something that had actually nothing to do with the literal interpretation of a mammoth. The real clincher came with the observation that certain signs appear repeatedly in pairs. Negative hands and dots tend to be one of the most frequently painted, for example, especially during a warm climate period known as the Gravettian, between 28,000 to 22,000 years ago. One site known as Les Trois Frères in the French Pyrenees even shows 4 sign types grouped together: negative hands, dots, finger fluting, and thumb stencils. Grouping is typically seen in early pictographic languages. The combined symbols represent a new concept, and the researchers suspect that prehistoric Europeans had established a similar system. Suspecting that this was just the beginning of what the symbols could tell us about prehistoric culture, they both then looked to track down where and when this emerged. The line turned out to be the most popular, being present at 70% of the sites and appearing across all time periods from the 30,000 to 10,000 years ago. The next most prolific sign were the open angle symbol and the dot, both appearing at 42% of the sites throughout the period. Yet, while long winters spent in caves might have induced people to spend time painting wonder walls, there are reasons to think that symbols originated much earlier. One of the most intriguing facts to emerge from this work is that more than 3/4 of the symbols were present in very early sites from over 30,000 years ago. This incredible diversity and continuity of use suggests that the symbolic revolution may have occurred before the arrival of the first modern humans in Europe. The idea would seem to fit with a few tantalizing finds that have emerged from Africa and the Middle East over recent years. At Blombos Cave in South Africa's Southern Cape, for example, archaeologists have recently discovered pieces of hematite engraved with abstract designs that are at least 75,000 years old. Meanwhile, at the school rock shelter in Israel, there are shell beads, considered by some to be personal ornaments and evidence of symbolic behaviour as far back as 100,000 years. Does it suggest that these symbols travel with prehistoric tribes as they migrated from Africa? Well, Ian Davison, an Australian rock art specialist at the University of New England in New South Wales, is unconvinced that they have a common origin, maintaining that the creative explosion occurred independently in different parts of the globe around 40,000 years ago. Wherever these symbols did emerge, the acceptance of symbolic representation would have been a turning point for these cultures. For one thing, it would have been the first time that they could permanently store information. One huge question remains, of course: what do these symbols actually mean? Well, with no Rosetta Stone to act as a key for translation, the best we can do is guess at their purpose. Our ancestors' secrets remain safe. Well, for now, at least. Although I'm expecting by the end of next week, there'll be a few crazy ideas out there. A megalithic settlement has recently been unearthed at Skendal Village, 10 kilometres from the town of Pagaralam in southern Sumatra. Local residents have discovered around 36 different types of rock on a 150 by 300 metre plot in the middle of a 2-hectare coffee plantation. The site is currently being investigated by the Archaeological Region Conservation and Heritage Centre. The finds are believed to date back to around 5000 BCE. The types of rocks and megaliths found are quite diverse. Among the items are a mortar and a 1 by 1.3 metre relief showing a woman riding an elephant with two children, and people being attacked by crocodiles and large snakes, as well as several altars believed to have been used for offerings. Oh, a woman riding an elephant with two children? Sounds amazing. Sounds a bit like my town on a Saturday night as well. Last January, we reported that the discovery of stone hand axes on the Mediterranean island of Crete, indicating that an ancient Homo species had used rafts or other seagoing vessels to cross from North Africa to Europe via at least some of the larger islands in between. Now the debate is raging on. "I was flabbergasted," said Boston University archaeologist and stone tool expert Curtis Runnels. "The idea of finding tools from this early time period on Crete was about as believable as finding an iPod in King Tut's tomb." Even so, as researchers from the Directorate of Paleoanthropology and Speleology of South Greece and four US universities combed the island, evidence of this unlikely journey kept on mounting. The team, led by Providence College archaeologist Thomas Strasser, found more than 30 hand axes, as well as other stone tools of similar vintage, embedded in geological deposits at 9 different locations on the southwestern coast of Crete, near the town of Plakeias. Some artefacts have been eroded out of the caves in the sea cliffs, becoming incorporated into ancient beach deposits. Over time, geological processes lifted these ancient beaches up and away from the shore, forming natural terraces. The team's geologists dated the youngest of these terraces associated with hand axes at least 45,000 years ago using radiocarbon dating. And they estimate the oldest terrace with stone tools is at least 130,000 years ago. Although archaeologists had found hints of early humans on Crete, these new discoveries, say Strasser, are the first geologically datable finds. It seems likely that future research will support this initial discovery. If ancient humans were crossing the Mediterranean, Runnels said, then they were certainly able to cross other water barriers, such as the Red Sea or the Gulf of Aden. And that would mean that the assumption that we had the peopling of Eurasia done by early hominins moving overland through the Near East into India and down has to be revisited. Jeff Bailey, an archaeologist at York University in England and an expert on ancient coastal migrations, calls the idea of such ancient sea crossings plausible, but he thinks the team need to find and conduct excavations at sites where ancient humans were actually making and using these stone tools. At present, the earliest widely accepted evidence of ancient seafaring comes from Australia. to reach the southern continent from the Southeast Asian mainland some 50,000 years ago, modern humans had to cross a 600-mile-long band of islands and at least 10 ocean straits. Moreover, Michael Morwood, an archaeologist at the University of New England in Armidale, Australia, has long proposed that Homo erectus voyaged from the Indonesian island of Bali to nearby Flores, where excavations have revealed 700 to 800,000-year-old stone tools. If additional work confirms that the earliest stone tools on Crete do date back more than 130,000 years, archaeologists may want to take a closer look at these hypotheses. One solid bet is that archaeologists will be giving more thought in years to come. We'll be giving more thought in years to come to the question of why early humans chose to venture out to sea in the first place. Former Irish Attorney General John Rogers, who lives in the Boyne Valley, will be amongst objectors to plans by Meath County Council and the National Roads Authority to build a bypass of Slane, 500 metres from the Bruna Boyne archaeological complex. Depending on the number of objections, the An Bord Pleanaill may decide to hold an oral hearing. The proposed route running east of Slane is being opposed by the newly formed Save Newgrange campaign, led by Vincent Salafia, who was prominent in the protracted struggle against the M3 motorway because of its proximity to the Hill of Tara. He said that Save Newgrange had lodged a formal complaint with the European Commission, alleging the public consultation process was flawed and calling on the Commission to intervene so the deadline could be extended for 90 days. The environmental impact statement on the bypass proposal says it would remove through traffic from the existing N2 through Slane, improving the village's environment as well as giving an improved level of service on the route. However, it does concede that the new stretch of the N2 route would be just over 500 metres from the UNESCO World Heritage site of Bruna Boyne, comprising the three main prehistoric sites of Newgrange, Nowth and Douth on the banks of the Boyne. The assessment identified 44 archaeological and cultural heritage constraints within 500 metres of the route. Of these, 5 will be impacted directly, 2 will be impacted indirectly, and 34 will have no predicted impact. Well, let's see if Mr. Salafia does better on this campaign. Students at a Cambridgeshire college in England have begun an archaeological dig of their artefact-rich grounds. Previous excavations at the Linton Village College have revealed evidence of a Roman settlement and Bronze Age burial. Neolithic pits, also dug 5,000 years ago, have been found there. The dig is part of a year-long art, archaeology and filmmaking project funded by a £25,000 lottery grant. Archaeologist David Crawford-White, who is working with the students, said that we don't know what we will find, but it's almost certain that we will find something. The students are teaming up with professional filmmakers to record their findings. 13 projects look to set to receive money from Orkney Islands Council Fund for archaeological investigations in 2010. Members of the Orkney Islands Council Development Committee have backed recommendations to award funding to the project selected by a panel made up of the Manager of Museums and Heritage, the County Archaeologist and the Orkney Museum's Curator of Archaeology. Well, set to receive the highest amount is the ongoing excavation on the Ness of Brodgar, which is described in the report as having a huge tourism potential, as well as exciting archaeology. Led by Nick Card of the Orkney Research Centre for Archaeology, the project has been allocated £8,000. Other similar projects were also successful in attracting funding, including the Bray of Halbert in Wyre. The Hoy and the South Walls landscape interpretation work has been approved for £4,500 of funds. This project is a continuation of another scheme that has so far hugely changed the interpretation of the area of Hoy, including a mound previously thought to be a broch, turning out to be a Neolithic chambered cairn. Expected to receive £1,500 is Oxford University's Bursey Scale Landscape Archaeology Project, which councillors heard should deliver interesting results. Due to its huge media potential, the Wrapping Places Interpreting the Ring of Buchan Complex project has been approved for £2,500. The investigation is led by Dr. Colin Richards of the University of Manchester. 3 geophysics projects led by Dr. Susan Ovenden of Orkney College look likely to receive £1,000 each. These include ongoing geophysics works in the World Heritage Area Inner Buffer Zone, which completes a long-running programme of magnetometry, and the Scale Lock Environs project. Dr. Ovenden's third successful project is the World Heritage Area LIDAR Zone, which is approved for funding because it enables Orkney to contribute to the National Scotland's 10 programme. Well, the reason I put all that in is because actually I do have a great big soft spot for Orkney. So well done to them all. Another thing that I have a great big soft spot for, and I hope you do too, is Past Horizons magazine, Adventures in Archaeology. If you haven't read it yet, issue 11 is out now with some fabulous articles about Maya. We've got Norway, and, well, dear, I'll tell you what, go along and have a look for yourself. www.pasthorizons.com/magazine. And there you can go straight to issue 11 or browse the back catalogue. So www.pasthorizons.com/magazine. Can I also remind you that you can toddle along to my website as well. It's www.bajr.org, where you can find many new archaeological and heritage employment opportunities. And remember, more can always be found at Stonepages, news.stonepages.com. Thanks again for listening to this Archaeology News Weekly. Return again to us next week.